She arrived at New York's Frick Museum like a touring megastar. The girl with a pearl earring was given a room all her own. Lines formed, visitors gawked at Vermeer's masterpiece.
It's amazing. It's just lovely. I mean, it's just lovely.
Judy Blakey and Sarah Campbell came from York, Pennsylvania to see her.
What is it about her expression?
It's the way her mouth is open and that surprised look on her face. I just think it's beautiful.
But something happened in another room at the Frick. Another Dutch painting started drawing attention. A painting of a pet goldfinch chained to its perch.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. All across America, there are mansions, art museums, and gardens, but very few places offer all three in one. The Frick Collection in Manhattan is one of the most well-known examples. Philbrook recently teamed up with the Frick for a new program called Social Swap that's kind of an exchange program for quote-unquote house museums. I invited Alexis Light, the Frick's senior manager of media relations and marketing, to come down to Tulsa and take over Philbrook's social media for a weekend. I'll be heading up there soon for my turn. We also had a chance to sit down with Alexis and talk about some of the opportunities and the challenges that come with these special kinds of museums. So you've been at the Frick for how long now?
In October, it'll be 11 years.
11 years. Yeah. So you started there right at the beginning kind of the change from museums using old media or whatever we want to call it, mm-hmm. traditional media, mm-hmm. to adopting new media and
yes.
social media
yes.
in 2007. What were you expecting to do at that time? Just grow an audience, or what were people expecting in 2007?
I mean, I don't think that there was really an expectation. I think it was just sort of this thing where we were like, oh, maybe we should have a Facebook page. And we were noticing that other museums, you know, in the city in particular, were starting to adopt these platforms as ways to communicate with their audience. So it was sort of like, do we try that?
This is kind of a keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah,
kind
in
of
a way.
Thing.
You know, sometimes the Frick can be, you know, on the forefront of technology, and that, like, we were one of the first museums that had a virtual tour on our website. And, you know, we were part of, you know, one of the first museums that joined the Google Art Project when that came into being. But
and the Google Art Project, for those who don't know, is Google, the behemoth tech company,
yes.
has a foot in the waters of art and culture, and they reach out to museums, and the museums put basically a version of their collection or selections from their collection online on this kind of online gallery. And there's different things. You can do virtual tours. But you guys were one of the first ones to get in on that.
Yeah, there was 17 museums that first go around, and we were one of the first ones. And so what that entailed was having a number of works of art from our collection on this website, as well as some zoomable big, big pictures that you could zoom in and see all the details. And then this, what they call a street view of the inside of your museum. And so there's things like that where we're very, like,
kind
you know,
of early
jumping,
adopter,
early,
yeah.
early adopters. And then there's other things where we try to be a little bit more measured and, you know, sort of think it through. And Facebook, you know, we weren't one of the first people to get a Facebook page, but we were certainly, you know, once we sort of saw
looking on the early side.
Yeah, you know, once we saw that it was where sort of the tide was going, we got on board. And then Twitter, and then Pinterest.
And this is all pre-Instagram.
Yeah, and then one day, I actually know the dates, like February 13th or February 15th, 2013, I was like, let's start an Instagram
page.
That's
the birthday of the Frick Instagram page.
Yeah. And so I remember, you know, this is funny that I work in social media and new media, but I'm not a huge social media person in my personal life. I don't have a Facebook page that I use on a regular basis, and I don't have Twitter. But when I got my first iPhone, I got Instagram and was like, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me my whole life. So I was a huge fan of Instagram. in that interim. And so I went into my boss's office and I was like, maybe we should get an Instagram account. The rest is history.
In that time, Instagram has undoubtedly taken the reins as the kind of dominant platform, at least for museums especially.
Yeah, and for us too, especially, I mean, for museums in general, but for the Frick in particular, Instagram is our most followed platform. It has surpassed Facebook. It has surpassed Twitter. You know, obviously our website is our website, but in terms of the social media platforms, Instagram is the one that really has the captive audience at the moment.
And there's no, you know, over the last, you know, decade or so, and I've been in that same world for about the same amount of time, there have been whispers and rumors of new things, and occasionally there'll be like the next big thing, and there's a new platform announced, and here's Vine, and all these different things. But they come and go.
Yeah.
And Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, this kind of trinity of social, have stayed. Now they've swapped places in terms of relevance, but they're still the three main platforms. Do you see anything new on the horizon that could take the place of any of those?
I mean, I can't imagine that something new is going to come out where you're going to completely abandon any of those three things. I think, you know, what's in a way, I guess, has been sort of genius about the way that things have gone is that they've been able to sort of combine or share, you know, you can share things to each thing from one particular app, which I think makes it easier to keep them as like the big three, if you will. I mean, we had, you know, at one time tried to venture out into using Snapchat and building an audience on that platform. And once Instagram got stories, it was like, what, why, you know, because we already had that audience right there. And it just, you know, it made it that much more easier to sort of stay within that platform.
The Snapchat, for the most part, unless you're talking about teenagers, and it's fading within that demographic too, is dying.
I don't think it didn't work for us, you know. I mean, I think other museums are doing great work on that app, and I've seen some great stuff. It just didn't flesh out for us.
So in the early days of social for museums, there were no paid ads in the early days.
Right.
And it was kind of a wild west. You could kind of try things, experiment. But when things started to become more corporatized and more monetized, did you guys have to start really thinking about, okay, our reach has been reduced because of algorithms and different things like that. Are we going to start now putting some of our budget into these platforms? Whereas before, for the first few years, you're kind of just doing it because it's this great free tool and you're not having to spend money on it. You're reaching people with no cost. Do you guys put some money now into these efforts?
We definitely kind of play around with boosting posts on Facebook. We haven't had sort of a rigorous sort of digital marketing campaign that was related to
like a
social
line item budget for.
But we've done posts, you know, we've been boosting posts here and there and that kind of stuff. Just, you know, when it's something important or we feel like it's getting a lot of traction, we'll like throw some money at it. But in this fiscal year, actually, we did put some money aside that specifically for advertising, kind of, you know, dipping our toe into what it would be like to have an actual strategic plan related to, you know, social advertising. So we'll see, to be determined.
So there are many kinds of house museums or historic homes, from Biltmore to the Hearst Castle.
Yeah.
But there aren't a lot that combine gardens, a historic home, and a functioning fine art museum. And one of those overlaps is what's interesting between Philbrook and the Frick.
Right.
And the Frick was opened in 1935. Philbrook opened in 1938. So pretty close, you know, right around that same time period. Who was Mr. Frick? Can you tell us about him?
Henry Clay Frick was a coke and steel magnate from Pittsburgh. And so that's where he made his money. He was always interested in collecting art. There's a fun anecdote that when he went to the bank to get the loan for his first refinery, the first place he was, you know, trying to build, I guess the banker came and sort of assessed it and then said, you know, I think this is going to be okay. He has an interest in, you know, art, but it's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Like, and then he becomes this, you know, art collector and has amassed one of the, you know, most important collections of art in the world. So he lives in Pittsburgh. In the early part of the 1900s, they move to New York and they start construction on the house that's on Fifth Avenue and 70th Street in 1914. And then Frick only lives in the house for 5 years, and he dies in 1919. So,
yeah, so 100 years next year is the anniversary of his death. 100 years.
Yeah. You know, I think Mr. Frick always knew that he wanted to sort of leave this house as a museum. It wasn't a secret, but it also wasn't, you know, I think he always knew he wanted to do that. So, you know, in his will, he said that his wife could live there until she died, which was in 1931 or 32, and then we opened as a museum in 1935.
So Philbrook and the Frick, they open in the middle of the Great Depression, 1930s, these opulent places, kind of these larger-than-life philanthropists who leave these things to the city. You don't see a lot of that happening now. You see a lot of foundations, but you don't see people opening new museums all the time. But one interesting example of that is the Crystal Bridges Museum, which was started by Alice Walton of the, you know, Sam Walton family, the Walmart family.
Yes.
But what's different is obviously that was a totally built new thing. It wasn't as if she turned her home into a thing. But there was a moment in American history where this kind of thing was happening. Because if you look at the Cooper Hewitt Museum, that was Andrew Carnegie's home. And there's the Getty and other things like that, too.
Right.
You know, what's the reason for that happening so much back then?
I mean, that is a good question. Maybe for Frick, you know, he was thinking about this as being like, you know, the house was part of the collection. You know, if he built this sort of monument and then filled it with these beautiful works of art and then felt that he wanted to leave that, you know, as a whole to the public so that they could experience the collection as he would when he lived there. You know what I mean? So when you go to the Frick, you're experiencing it very closely to the way that Mr. Frick did or his family did when they lived in the house. There's a couple of rooms in the collection where we've sort of either it's remained that way in its entirety or we've sort of rehung those rooms to invoke the spirit of when Mr. Frick was there, what it was like when he lived in the house. So I think that's the idea. Same thing when you go to like the Gardner or something in Boston, you're really kind of feeling like you're walking in their footsteps.
Philbrook, for many years of our history, was more like that, meaning there was the furniture of the family was there. The rooms were more historical.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the late 80s, when the museum built on a more modern wing, the historic home part became more traditional gallery space. There are still elements and some pieces that kind of give you that sense, but it's not like you can walk into a room and say, this is what it looked like exactly in this period, blah, 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 blah. But we do have people every day asking about that. It's probably the thing people want to know the most when they're in the villa. They want to know, what did this look like in 1937 or whatever? Change can be difficult for historic home museums because there is a big chunk of the audience that wants to step back in time. How do you guys embrace changing galleries, finding that balance between staying new and relevant versus always just being a look into the past?
Well, I mean, I will say that there's not a lot of like movement at the Frick in terms of moving things around. So there's a lot of like the permanent collection is kind of where it is. But then we also have our special exhibitions. So, you know, we're kind of infusing this new energy, you know, every 6 or 8 or 12 weeks, you know, as when we get a new show or something every season. But that's what's so great about the platforms with the messaging that we're doing. It allows us to maybe take something that's been there for 100 years and, you know, talk about it in a different perspective or maybe, you know, do like a Throwback Thursday where you can show like a historic, we have historic photos, but then we also, it looks exactly the same now.
Right.
So it's kind of fun to be like, here's what it looked like in, you know, Frick's day, but also it looks just like this and this is why. Or, you know, we can do a Throwback Thursday for a room that used to be a bedroom that's now an office, you know, and there's like a bed and, you know, a vanity or something. And now it's like, here's the office of the director of the museum. So, and people love that pulling back the curtain.
What role, so, you know, New York obviously has so many great museums. What role does the Frick play in the broader ecosystem of museums in New York?
We definitely were sort of a boutique or niche kind of experience. I mean, we're obviously not the Met. We're just down the street from them. But they, you know, you can get any flavor you like at the Met. And I think what's great about the Frick is that, again, you're entering into this sort of like very special domestic, intimate, reflective sort of setting, and you're walking through and you're seeing things that were, you know, you're seeing someone's home, you're seeing someone's vision, you're looking at objects they collected or that were collected sort of under their, you know, influence or what have you. And, you know, you don't get that at a lot of places in New York. You know, I mean, that's just, it's like a.
So the point of view specifically?
Yeah, it's a point of view. It's definitely, you know, we like to, I think it's something special that you're not going to get going into the Met or going into MoMA and going to the Guggenheim. And not that those are, you know, those are fantastic institutions. It's just they don't.
Well, that's nice that it kind of creates this mosaic of experiences you can, you know, because you wouldn't want redundancy. But, you know, the idea that you guys are very different is only only a benefit to
you. Yeah, we definitely celebrate that. We're definitely like, you saw a couple of Vermeers at the Met. Come down and see the other three that are in New York, you know. it's just different. You know, I mean, I think by virtue of having it be a domestic space and not having it be your typical sort of like museum experience, it enhances the work.
There is this David and Goliath thing. You're right down the street from the Met. You're never going to have obviously the space or the funding even or the resources that they have. But there are moments where you guys can, you know, for a small what you call boutique museum, yeah, fight way above your weight class. And I'm thinking back to 2013. You guys have this show where you have, you obviously have, you have three Vermeers in the collection already. And then you're bringing in the girl with the pearl earring.
Yeah, you're talking about the Moritz show. Yes, that was a fantastic moment to be working at the Frick for a number of reasons. One, because, you know, who doesn't want to spend, you know, a couple of months with the girl with the pearl earring? And two, it was just such a, we had never experienced anything like that.
Let's talk about this. So you find out you're going to do it probably a year, a couple of years in advance.
Like 5 years in advance.
Yeah, so 5 years.
Yeah, something like that.
When do you make it public? How far out are you talking about?
I think
about
we announced
like that?
that show was happening maybe a year and a half before.
And so immediately, are people just freaking out?
People are very excited.
Are you selling tickets right away or how is it?
We had time ticketing. I'm not exactly sure when they went on sale, but we definitely had a lot of excitement.
And this is, for the most part, people are basing their enthusiasm off of one work. There's a lot of works in the view. But the girl with the pearl earring is the thing that's probably for the general public getting people excited.
Yes, because that's the work. That's like, you know, the work that everybody knows.
And,
it's,
you know,
the movie,
that had been coming off of a book and the film. And, by the time you guys had it there in 2013, its cultural relevancy and recognition was at a peak, probably.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So that happens. You have this show. There's so much buzz. People are lining up to see it.
Right.
And then something else happens.
Yes. So what's interesting about that show is that we were sort of getting ready for all of the frenzy around the work by Vermeer, you know, preparing and all of that and printing, you know, we got T-shirts made. We had like all this.
Got your merch.
All of our merch was ready to go. I had made a cardboard cutout of her and I was going to take her around the city for some Instagram, which was going to be fun.
And this is right when Instagram happens.
We'd had an Instagram account for maybe.
Perfect timing.
Yeah, it was perfect timing. Like a couple, maybe like 8 months at that point. Yeah. So we're like ready to go, girl, whole bit. Yeah. And then I would say a couple of months before the show opened, we got a phone call from a news outlet that wanted to interview the writer Donna Tartt at the Frick. And the Frick has a policy where, you know, we only allow photo and film shoots that has something to do with the, you know, museum or work of art or whatever. And so I was just like, you know, we really appreciate you thinking of us, but this just doesn't seem to fit, you know.
Thanks, but no thanks.
We love Donna Tartt, but like, thank you. I can't, you know, do this.
Yeah.
And then, like right before, maybe like a couple weeks before the show started, we realized that Donna Tartt was publishing a book called The Goldfinch that was based on the painting The Goldfinch that was going to be in the exhibition, and it was coming out on the same day that the show was opening.
And so The Goldfinch painting is a very small work.
Very small.
It's just a picture of a goldfinch on a little perch.
Right.
And its leg is chained to the perch. There's a little chain
a little
on there.
Chain. Yes.
And this was used as the cover image and title and one of basically the main plot element of this book, which is The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, which became a phenomenon.
Right.
It won the Pulitzer Prize.
Right.
And people were just reading it like crazy. I mean, it's probably one of the, in terms of fiction, one of the biggest books of the last, you know, of the 21st century so far. Obviously, that's totally unplanned.
Unplanned.
You guys had no idea 5 years before.
No idea.
So this all happens. And the shift is not taken off of The Girl with the Pearl Earring, but all of a sudden it's kind of a, it's a duet instead of a solo
show.
Well,
I like to say that people came for The Girl, but they stayed for The Goldfinch.
Yeah.
That's my little marketing thing. But no, it was fantastic because—
But at some point, people were walking in with their book, and they were coming for The Goldfinch.
It definitely opened the show up to an entirely, maybe not entirely new audience, but an audience that I don't think we were anticipating showing up because book clubs were, you know, from all over the tri-state area were like coming in to see, you know, these busloads of book club people coming in to see the painting and all kinds of, you know, it was.
So after that, are you letting those news organizations come in now since you already turned them down the first time?
No, I mean, we're open to all news organizations. Obviously, we'd love to have good press. But it was just interesting to see the shift in audience, and it was exciting to see that people who maybe aren't necessarily art lovers in that way, but who were so enthusiastic about the book coming into the museum.
And this is a painting that, unless
experience.
You were fairly well versed in this kind of art, you probably wouldn't have heard about it ever before. I mean, it was known, but not well known.
And the girl definitely was the draw. So the girl with the earring and then other objects on loan to us from the Moritz House, which were fantastic, world class, beautiful paintings. But, you know, if you're not an art person, but you are a literary person and you liked this book and you were like, oh, the paintings, you know, in New York, I'm going to go see it. You know, why not?
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Slightly Creepy Portraits, from old men with wonky eyes to children who bear a striking resemblance to those twins from The Shining.
Come and play with us, Daddy.
A museum just isn't complete without a few slightly creepy portraits. Frankly, we here at Museum Confidential are still haunted nightly by some portraits we saw in museums as children. And remember, if you think they're looking directly at you, you're probably right.
How does a relatively small museum deal with that kind of buzz and attendance? Because like I said, you know, there was a – how long was that show up for?
It was up from October into January.
Okay.
Yeah.
So through the holiday season.
Yeah.
And you're seeing just droves of people.
Yes.
Was that unlike anything up to that point that you'd ever seen personally?
Yes,
at the museum?
It was unlike anything I'd ever seen up to that, you know. And I think, you know, I think there might have been one other show in the history of the institution that was kind of a phenomenon like that. I think there was a Whistler show, and then maybe there was a show that was related to fairies that we did previous to that. But this was like, up to this point, I think that was like the biggest thing. And I mean, we've had other successful shows, Van Dyke, for example, the Zubaran show last year, but this was
a true phenomenon
on another level. Yeah.
There was an article years ago, I think it was in Vanity Fair, and it was about Michael Jackson. It may have been after he'd passed away. And the article was written by a woman who had interviewed Michael Jackson from when he was a kid all the way through almost to the end of his life at different points in his career. And they were talking about him and his unhappiness in certain ways. And she said, he never understood that Thriller, the album Thriller, was a phenomenon and could not be replicated because so much of its success had to do with, yes, of course, the talent and the songs, but the time, MTV was new, all these things kind of came to play. And he, even though had so many successes after that, none of them reached that level. And he couldn't ever understand that you couldn't replicate a phenomenon because the phenomenon by its very nature is a one-off thing, right?
Right.
So if you guys had this amazing show and then in February, when the show's over, you sit down as a team and go, how can we do another one of these? You can't really.
I think that was a moment in time, and I don't think we sit down and plan the exhibitions that we do in that way. I think we're like, with our special exhibitions, I think we just want to be able to provide visitors the opportunity to see fantastic works of art and learn and have access and experience things they might not otherwise experience, you know, because some of these things are coming from other countries that they're not be traveling to or, you know, other cities that they've never been to. And so it's really more about like providing people with an experience and enhancing, you know, their lives through art. So.
Well, thanks for chatting with us.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Alexis Light in conversation with Jeff Martin. I'm Scott Gregory. You're listening to Museum Confidential. Now we will begin a new occasional feature on this podcast. At a Museum in America is what we're calling it. And our correspondent is Preston Poe, an independent curator, artist, and songwriter. Here kicking things off with a piece recorded at the Denver Art Museum recently.
I'm at a museum in America. Today I'm at the Denver Art Museum and I'm checking out New Territory Landscape Photography today. Eric Pettick is the curator of photography and his statement is that we're all taking pictures and we're using social media and we're looking at the world in unique ways all the time. And the fact is that we're looking at the world in new ways and the world's changing around us. And photography is over 100 years old, but people are still doing really remarkable and interesting things. And this is a great example of how something has stayed and predictable in theory as landscape photography can be fresh, new, exciting, and unpredictable. We had the good fortune of running into Eric at the exhibition, and he talked a little bit about some of the works here in the show.
Matthew Brandt is the photographer who created this Waianae installation. Waianae is a location in Hawaii where his native Hawaiian wife grew up. when he goes back to visit, he photographs the rainforest, prints the photographs, and then takes them back to Hawaii, rolls them up in fabric, might be burlap, it might be lace, and buries them. And he leaves them there. And his brother-in-law goes out and sprinkles the ground with a hose and stuff like that, and eventually he'll come back. They dig them up, they unroll them, they peel the textile away, and it pulls part of the image off. But other parts of the image have been kind of digested by microorganisms, and it affects the dyes and the color of the print. So what you're looking at is images of rainforests that are partly deteriorated, and to me, it's kind of like perfect representation of the biology of a rainforest, where the health of the rainforest depends entirely upon the deterioration of the leaves that fall off the trees and the animals that die and fertilize the soil. And besides, they're just kind of beautiful and evocative.
They are really beautiful. They're much more beautiful than our listener would think hearing that description, right? They're really colorful and dynamic, and they sort of look like if you gave Gerhard Richter an opportunity to do something with a camera.
Yes.
I like it a lot. What was your inspiration for doing this exhibition? How'd you get the idea?
I was confused. I was baffled. I was seeing a lot of work that I didn't understand, and kind of thought about it and decided I had the choice of being the curmudgeonly old curator who stuck with the stuff that he knew and loved from graduate school, or I could look at a whole mess of this new stuff and try to figure it out.
So these are all living artists now. This is contemporary art.
Yes, the earliest work in the show was made in 1998, and the most recent piece in the show was produced at the end of March this year.
I love it. It's a great show. I think that there's a conversation with the past, but I don't think it's just a conversation about the past. I think it's also a conversation about the future.
You know, there are correspondences between many of the photographs in this exhibition and well-known photos from the 19th century and the 20th century, and I think that's one of the things that makes it fun and interesting to look at.
This is Preston Poe, and I'm at a museum in America.
Preston Poe is an independent curator, artist, and songwriter. You can learn more about him, including his podcast, at PrestonPoe.com.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org. Or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.